Hi, I'm Tatiana Rotre, and you are listening to Crazy Grief, the podcast. Grief can make us feel like we're going crazy. It affects our emotions, our physical health, and our mental state. It has a huge impact on the way we relate to people and the way we see ourselves. Crazy Grief is a safe space for us to have candid conversations about grief and all the crazy stuff that comes with it. We are here to share our stories, how we cope with grief, and what kind of help really helps. If you lost your person and you feel like you're going crazy, let me reassure you, you're not going crazy. You're just grieving. So let's talk about it. Our guest today is Victoria Hathaway. Victoria is a counselor specialized in ACT, Acceptance Commitment Therapy. For many years, she has worked as a teacher, but now she runs her own counseling practice. She's a wife, a mother to three young men, and she also is a very gifted poet and writer, and she's my friend. Hi, Vic.
Hi, Teddy. I'm good. Thanks.
Oh, my God. It's so good to have you here. I'm really looking forward to our talk.
Yeah, likewise.
We talk a lot about a lot of things. We go really deep into some very important conversations. And I always get a lot every time I talk to you, every time we have dinner together, every time we have an interaction on the phone. You are one of those people that just really blesses me and enriches me and challenges my perspective on things. And I often feel like I'm so grateful to have you in my life. And I'm really hoping that people can receive the amazing well of kindness and information that you have to give. So I'm going to stop talking now and I'm going to dive straight right in. So the first question that I want to ask is, what can you please tell us a little bit about ACT?
Sure. So ACT therapy, and by the way, likewise to everything you said, I think between us we've solved all of the world's problems.
Yes.
So yeah. ACT therapy or acceptance and commitment therapy is probably of all the types of therapy, my very favourite one, because it doesn't require the person receiving ACT or practicing ACT, it doesn't require them to challenge their uncomfortable thoughts or feelings. It doesn't require them to try and replace it or replace them. It doesn't require them to fight with what they're thinking or feeling. It's partly mindfulness-based. So really what it is for the person who is practicing ACT is just an acceptance of their thought or feelings without challenging or even questioning if they're right or wrong. So it's more noticing, accepting, and then traveling towards your valued direction. So it's quite a valued-based therapy. For example, if someone came to therapy with anxiety, instead of getting that person to try and fight that anxiety, you'd ask them to make room for it. You know, there's many different ways we can do that, to make room for that anxiety so they can continue traveling in their valued direction. Often the anxiety can hook a person, and once they're hooked, it takes them deeper and deeper. With ACT therapy, we'd ask them to unhook from that feeling, but still travel along with the anxiety side by side in their valued direction. You know, as a result, their anxiety could lessen, but that's not the aim. The aim is to be able to make room and travel along with whatever it is that's bothering you without letting it stand in your way.
So do you think that by, have you seen this on your clients that practice ACT therapy, is that correct to say?
Yeah.
That the acceptance of the things that they cannot change somehow helps them to build resilience and create a larger life that is not dominated by what they are struggling with?
Yeah, I do. I think what it does is it gives them freedom to not beat themselves up when they're not seeing, say, with anxiety or depression, seeing it lessen. They can just accept that, make room for it, but it's not holding them back from doing the things that they want to do with their lives. Mm. Often these things can stand in our way, but if we can it's almost like what you pull focus on. So if you're feeling, say, very depressed and you've got your focus on the depression, what we're trying to do is pull focus onto your values instead. So the depression might still be there, mm-hmm. but it's no longer the focal point.
I see. So the depression or the anxiety or whatever you're struggling with is a part of a larger picture of your life.
Yeah, it's one of the things.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is really interesting for me because I think that a lot of people have the tendency, and me included, into wanting to fix something that seems to be wrong, you know, or for me, for example, I wanted to fix what's wrong with me. And often I find myself asking that question, you know, I made lots of mistakes today and I was sharing those with you before. And my default setting is to go, oh my God, what is wrong with me?
Yeah.
And that question alone shows that I have a lot of still self-judgment, self-criticism, trying to have almost like buying into the narrative, the illusion that I can fix what is wrong, quote unquote, with me and then have a better life. But from what you're saying, it's almost like there is nothing wrong with you. You just are a human being having a human experience that is part of a larger experience. And even though that one might be something that you kind of want to wish it away or push it away or fix it away, you can't. So acceptance is a really big part of moving forward with it.
That's right. So what you described there, an act, we would call that fusion. So you're fused with an unhelpful thought. You're fused with the thought, there's something wrong with me. And so part of ACT therapy is defusing from that and coming to a place where you actually don't even make a judgment call. So you might get the thought, so you might have the unhelpful thought of something is wrong with me. We wouldn't even judge that thought as being a good thought or a bad thought. It would just simply be a thought. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm having the thought, there's something wrong with me. Is this helping me move in my value direction? Or when I hook into this unhelpful thought, is it actually dragging me away? Because when I start thinking there's something wrong with me, then I start behaving like there's something wrong with me, then I forget what's important to me. If I'm a young mum, and for example, and I'm fused with the thought I'm a bad mum, I fuse in with that thought, I hook into it, and then I start behaving like a bad mum because I go down and down and down and down. So for ACT therapy, we unhook from that thought and say, thank you, mind, for giving me the thought that I'm a bad mum. However, that's not helping me move in my value direction, which is to be a present, good man.
So it kind of guides you into, number one, you call your value direction, you know, so the things that are really important for you, the kind of person that you want to be, the kind of behavior you want to develop more in your life. But also it gives you that almost like an easy way of being an imperfect human being, right?
Yeah.
Which I think that I want to tie this to grief, because going back to those things of that we consider some things are really bad or some things need to be fixed, grief is one thing that cannot be fixed.
Yeah.
And the amount of times that I hear people saying that, I just wish I could take this away from you. I just wish I could fix it. What can I do? And often there is nothing you can do because nobody can bring your person that died back to life.
And so
how do you think that ACT can be beneficial, or the principles of ACT can be beneficial for someone who is grieving, especially in the early stages of grief, where you are tormented almost with so many thoughts? How you grieving feels wrong, what you experiencing feels really overwhelming, and the fear and the anger, it's kind of like you're bombarded with all of that. And then it feels like for some people, they go, how long am I going to feel this way? When am I going to be okay? When can I bounce back? Or people around you are giving you those kind of messages. After a year, you're going to be okay. And then 1 year goes by and you're not okay. So can ACT be some, you know, helpful for those kinds of people in those situations?
Yeah, I think ACT is really helpful in my opinion, in any situation. But if we were going to look at grief, ACT is all about making room for your feelings, making room for whatever it is that's presenting in your life. So in the situation of grief, you can make room for this grief. There is room there. The grief, although it's very uncomfortable and unpleasant, the aim of the therapy would not be to get rid of the grief, but to make room for the grief. Mm. So it would be you can live with this grief and still carry on in a direction that you consider a valued direction for your life, whatever that is at the time. So that could change as well. So your valued direction might be, I need to survive for the next year or whatever it is. Your valued direction might be, I have children and I still want to be present as a mum. So in ACT therapy, and it's very simplified what I'm saying here, but, you know, the big picture there is you can travel forward and be a good mum with the grief mm. without trying to squash it down or pretend it's not there or fight it.
Because then I guess if you pretend it's not there or if you try to fight it, you go back to that, what was the word I use, a fusion?
Yeah, you fuse.
You're fusing yourself with that, and that will kind of just pull you in a direction that you end up with the grief is all-consuming, right? Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. So I want to go away from ACT a little bit and just ask you personally, because we have talked about this before, about your experiences of grief. Mm. But at the same time, kind of going back with ACT in the back of our minds, because one of the things that you said about the grief experience right now and the feelings that you have around it, I want to explore that based on some of your experience with grief, which you have said to me before that you've experienced grief in different ways because you lost both of your parents and it was very different both ways for you. Can you share us a little bit about how it was when you lost your dad, what is the difference when you lost your mom, and what were the major themes that arise from those two types of grief that you experience?
Yeah, actually, I'll bring in my father-in-law as well. So my father-in-law died 16 years ago, when we were still quite, well, relatively young, and he died very unexpectedly. So he was just, he was young himself, out on a run one morning, and he just literally died of a heart attack on somebody's front lawn.
Wow.
So that grief was like that shocking grief where you're totally not expecting it, where it's the last thing on earth that you've even given any thought to. 5 years after that, my own father died, but that had been after a short journey with cancer. So we had some time to sort of prepare for that, although not a lot of time, but it was enough to not have that shock factor of the my husband's father. Yeah, and then 4 years ago, nearly, my mum died, and that was after an extremely long battle with Alzheimer's. So each three of those griefs were in some ways different from each other. Yeah, so talking of with my father-in-law, it was an immediate sense of anger for me. And I remember driving, I just had a baby, so I was sort of in the throes of all of that as well. But I remember driving to the house to where he had lived with his wife, feeling this incredible anger that I couldn't actually articulate why I was so angry, or actually who I was even angry with. But I remember just pounding the steering wheel, and just feeling such a sense of anger. And not really feeling like I could process it, maybe because I just had a baby, I had two other young children. But that feeling of unprocessed grief stayed for a long, long time. With my own father, we'd had quite a difficult relationship in a way. He was, personality, he was quite a loner, I guess. So when he was dying, you know, it was quite nice because we kind of rallied around him a little bit and had a few conversations. I felt after he died, I remember feeling really bad that I just couldn't, I wouldn't say it now, but at the time I felt like I couldn't grieve. Mm. It was just kind of an empty, strange feeling. In fact, there was even some feelings of relief that I didn't have to worry about kind of his judgment anymore of me, which I'd felt. Mm. Mm. And I'll come back to this in a moment, but then when my mum died after such a long battle with Alzheimer's, again it was a feeling of relief that she no longer had to live in a way that was clearly not the way that she'd ever want to live. Mm. So again, there was a feeling of relief, but it was also just a huge sadness, I guess, watching someone go through Alzheimer's. You know, it does take its toll. But again, I remember feeling this guilt that I wasn't as sad as what I thought I should be, you know, as what grief should be. And I think I've talked to you about this before, just quite sort of judging myself on that. And what was funny, and it happened for my dad as well, but for both my mum and dad, the grief came out at different times, months and years later, through even dreams that I'd have of them. And I'd wake up just sobbing, and I realized that my body had to go through some kind of a grief process that it, for some reason I hadn't allowed myself. So it would usually happen after I'd had a dream or a funny memory or something would pop up in my mind. And, you know, even now, so many years later with my dad, I can still find that grief will sort of hit me at unexpected moments. But I guess what I learned through all of that was there is no right or wrong way to grieve. Mm. Yeah. That grief is just what it is. It's its own journey. It takes on its own path that I feel we have very little control over.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that, Vic, because I think that a lot of people, myself included, we really struggle with not grieving right. Mm. There is this weird, I don't know where it comes from, like this weird narrative in our society that there is a right way to grieve and the wrong way to grieve. Mm. And the right way might be just somebody being really stoic or really sad, or it's okay for men to that lost their wives to find a partner soon after because they are men and they need a woman. But it's not okay for a woman that have lost a husband, because it's almost like you don't know how to grieve. You're looking for ways to hold yourself up, sometimes to even get out of the bed in the morning. And yet there's all this underlying notions of how you should grieve that comes from other people or even from ourselves. And you touched on something that I think is really important, the self-judgment and the criticizing ourselves for feeling a certain way or not feeling a certain way. How, say somebody is going through this right now, what would be some suggestions that you might have based on ACT, that somebody that is struggling with all that, like not making room for those feelings or being overwhelmed by certain notions of how they should be grieving? Is there something in your specialization, I can't even say that word, in how you specialized with your clients about using certain techniques or insights through ACT that can help somebody to have some relief from that or to unhook, like what we were saying before?
Mm. So are you talking specifically if someone wasn't, if someone was feeling like they weren't grieving as much as they think they should, or?
Yeah, we can first explore that. So say, for example, in your experience, you felt like you were not grieving as much, or there was a sense of relief and somehow that feels like it's the wrong way to grieve. Mm-hmm. What would, if somebody came to you with an experience similar to yours as a therapist, how would you guide them to be able to go back into the direction of their values?
I think, and I'm not sure whether this is specifically ACT, this would just be my intuition as a counsellor, would be to say, from my experience of grief and what I've heard of from many other people in my life who have lost people, is that you can trust yourself with your grief journey. Yeah. So you don't have to worry about what you are or are not feeling, but you can trust that your body and your emotions will guide you and they will do what they need to do. And you don't need to worry about that. Just let your body naturally do its thing. For an example, what I said earlier about the dreams that I would have, that my body knew what it needed to do. For whatever reason, in the time it happened, I couldn't grieve or I couldn't summon up whatever feelings I thought I should summon up. But in time, my body released exactly what it needed to release in the exact right time, in the exact right place, when I was ready. So I would say in that situation, trust the process.
We often don't trust our bodies, though. And I think we trust even less our emotions because we have this illusion that we need to be in control. And then when somebody dies, we are smacked in the face of like, yeah, we have no control over anything. And yet somehow we are told or we require of ourselves to get back on a horse or move on or get back some control over our lives. And by doing that, I think we do ourselves a disfavor because we're not really listening to our bodies. We're disconnected from our bodies. We're trying to even disconnect from our emotions. I think part of it is because when the emotions are too big and we haven't been in tune with them for quite some time, which is what's happening more and more with our way of life in our society right now, I think that a fear that I myself experienced was that if I allow this emotion to be there and if I don't take some control over it, it will completely destroy me and it will completely crush me, and then I'm going to be no good for my kids or anything like that. So the fear is quite real. How is there another more helpful way or healthier way to think about those big emotions that we are scared to face?
I think it reminds me of something we were talking about earlier today, you know, before we were recording, and you were saying that you've realized, you know, that you can go right into that pain and feel it. And while it is painful and extremely raw, you survive it. And you come through it, and then it might hit you again 5 minutes later. It might hit you again the next day or the next week. But you know, because you faced it one time and you allowed it to, you know, you looked it in the face and let it encompass you, because you survived it, you know you can survive it again. It will not kill us. It's, you know, like you were saying, we can trust our bodies. We can trust our bodies that they're big enough to hold the grief. So there's lots of just thinking practically here. When you're feeling that sense of complete overwhelm, and I'll talk about ACT therapy since as we're on this sort of topic. One of the things we do is we encourage our clients, you know, with support, to go there to sort of feel the, if we're talking about grief, feel the grief. So breathe it in. Feel it, let it wash over you, because it is like a wave, like all emotions, you know, it's like a wave and it will wash over you, but it won't stay forever in that moment. It will wash over. And we just encourage sort of breathe into it, make space for it, let it be. And then there's the next part of it, which is bringing yourself back into the present moment. So once you've sort of allowed that emotion to come through, it's learning to regulate yourself again. So that's like, they call it an ACT, dropping anchor, which is just a grounding exercise of reminding yourself, my feet are on the floor, you know, the chair's supporting my back, there's four walls around me, and sometimes even doing a self-hold where you put your right hand underneath your left armpit, so closest to your heart, and your left hand goes on your right arm on the top of the forearm, and you hold yourself. And what that does is it reminds you, yes, I have a body around these emotions. Mm. It's like a container. Mm. I am contained. So even though there's a whirlwind of grief in me, I'm contained and I'm held. Mm. So it's kind of like a little bit of a dance. So it's feeling the emotion, feeling like it's going to overwhelm you, letting it pass through, then dropping anchor, holding yourself, feet are on the floor, and a reminder that you're contained, that you're going to be all right.
Yeah. And that you have yourself.
You have yourself. Right?
I think that it's really important to reconnect with that. And that was something that I think I had lots of ideas, or I thought I knew about it before Jason passed away, but it was almost like Jason was my anchor. Mm. And when he died, I felt really uncontained.
Yeah.
And so it was like the turmoil of everything that was around me, but then the turmoil of the that was inside of me. And that one I couldn't escape from, you know, wherever I was, with whomever I was, there was all this, you know, intense emotions that I was carrying all the time. And I felt very much like a seaweed being tossed about the grief waves. So I love what you're saying about grounding yourself and using the senses as well, like the sense of touching yourself, you know, of kind of going, almost you giving yourself a hug.
That's right.
And feeling the pressure of your own hands on your body and feeling the floor underneath you and feeling the chair if you're sitting down, just kind of putting your focus on what is actually really happening in this moment. You might feel like you are in danger. You might feel the fear might be so intense that it can elicit those feelings of unsafeness for you.
Yeah.
But in reality, in this moment, the reality is bigger than what you feel. You are in a safe place. Yeah. There's nobody there threatening your life. There, you are. You can breathe.
Yeah.
You can hold yourself. You can find some sort of security in you. You're not completely helpless.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's really important. I think it's important for, in fact, for anyone with any sort of trauma to learn some basic skills of grounding, of dropping anchor, of that reminder that, just as you said, right now I'm safe, regardless of the tempest that's raging inside me. Right now I'm safe, and just the comfort and the safety that's found in that is really important for people, especially if they feel out of control, to know there are little things they can do to just sort of pull it back together again, you know, and bring them back. It's really about just coming back to the present moment. But in doing that, it's not to run away or deny what's going on. It's simply, yeah, like you said before, for your own protection, your own safety, that you can go there, you can go to those deep, dark places, but you know you have the capacity to also bring yourself back.
We talked a little bit beforehand as well about how it is impossible to develop resilience without going through hardships. And I think I don't look at my personal journey of grief as, oh, yay, it's an opportunity to build resilience. Yeah. You know, it's not like that at all. But I can see that by me every day making a choice to be present with my grief, to face my fears, to actually take those steps of proactive looking after my own well-being. Which some days I'm very good at doing, and some days just it feels like everything's too much and it goes all out of the window. But I think by doing those things, it's almost like you're creating little messages for yourself that, hey, I've been here before, and perhaps 2 out of 10 times I was able to pull myself out of it. So that means that I can do it again. I think this is really important for mothers as well. My my desire for this podcast is to mainly focus on women that have lost their husbands, their wives, mm-hmm. their life partners, but who also have teenagers to look after, or perhaps, you know, younger kids as well. And the reason why I wanted to create this podcast was that when Jason died, Taimani was 15 and Kiana was 12, mm-hmm. and I was falling apart. And I have no family here in New Zealand. And so I felt really discombobulated, and I felt there was no grounding at all. I did not know how to hold myself and ground mm-hmm. myself. And the fear for me was that I was going to completely be crushed by all those big, scary emotions mm-hmm. and not be able to be the mother that my grieving children needed me to be. Mm-hmm. So I love what you're saying about creating some safety for yourself, because it's that thing of putting your oxygen mask first yeah. before you look mm-hmm. after your kids.
That's right.
And create room for their grief. Mm. If we do not learn how to find safety within ourselves, I think the main thing for me was I had to do this for my children.
Right, yeah.
So one of the things that you mentioned before, just backtracking a little bit, you mentioned about, you know, trusting your body, that there was dreams that you had. And I also had lots and lots of really funky dreams with yeah. Jason. So can we explore that a little bit more in terms of like the dreams? What, how do we, I don't know, find a way to be with dreams, which oftentimes, for me at least, were very unsettling.
Mm.
And then they kind of carry on the energy of that dream of yeah. losing Jason in the crowd, of mm-hmm. seeing him die. Like it carried on throughout the day yeah. with me. I was really impacted by those mm-hmm. dreams. How do we find a way to, I don't know what I'm asking. How do we deal with or use our dreams or find a way to decode our dreams in some way that they are not going to become another part of distress, but they will become another part of releasing the grief.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear what you're saying. I'm just thinking about that because a few of the dreams I had, some were quite healing actually. And it was quite clear what they were sort of about, but yeah, there were some that hit me like a freight train. Yeah, and it felt like I was saying my husband would say I was crying, you know, even in my sleep, then I'd just wake up and carry on crying.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it would probably be really similar to how you would deal with actual grief, because it is actual grief. So allowing yourself to go there, you know, to feel what you felt in the dream, to actually face it, just go right into the pain. And accept it for whatever your mind or your body is trying to release or sort out not to fight it or try and forget about it or shelve it. Yeah,
because that's another thing you have absolutely no control over what you dream.
No, none. In fact, it's probably some of the most honest grief because in your dreams you can't dictate, you know, in your dream what's going to happen next. What's happening is really truly your mind or your spirit or whatever it is you believe is producing the dream. It's your spirit really talking to you directly, and there's no filter.
Mm.
So, you know, they're quite powerful. Personally, for myself, I always write them down, and I write them down in as much detail as I can, including little bits and pieces that might seem insignificant. Because sometimes I found when I look back on those dreams, days, weeks, months, even years later, some things in it will make sense that at the time didn't make sense.
Mm. Yeah, I haven't done this before. Like just a few times that I had some very vivid dreams and then I wrote them down. And I hear what you're saying. Like I'm trying to write as fast as I can, and I'm like, oh my God, this is not making any sense. And as a writer, I'm like, should I edit this?
Yeah.
But then months later, when I read it again, I had many aha moments that in the moment was just kind of like was all a blur.
Yeah.
But later on in hindsight, it was like, oh, wow, this actually gives me some really deep insights about the state of how I was and what I actually need to start doing for myself, to look after myself. Mm-hmm. I just need to mention this. We are here, Victoria's room where she does her counseling, and there's this most beautiful bird with like so many colors just sitting out there in the middle of like this. The tree looks completely bare, and but the bird is amazing. And as I was pointing it out to her, I just thought about this metaphor about grief. Wasn't that bird incredible?
Oh,
like
beautiful.
So vivid colors, yellows and greens and blues and reds. And the tree looks so gray and dead. It looks completely dead.
Mm.
And I was just thinking about linking, my brain just linked that to grief. As in, it seems like our lives have become completely barren, and there's not one leaf, there's not one sign of life. And yet there are some things that will kind of land on us, maybe a dream, maybe an insight, maybe a new desire for to carry on, to create something for yourself, to leave a legacy that can just spark some joy and beauty. And oh my gosh, I just remember now about your poem that you're sharing with me. Like, and so Victoria just is in the middle of writing this poem, and she's an amazing writer. And everything you write, like, and when you share it with me, I know you're not writing it for me, but it feels like you're writing it for me. Like I often cry and weep, and it touched me so deeply, the things that you write. But this bird on the tree just reminded me of this poem that you started writing. Can you share a little bit about that?
So the poem I'm just writing at the moment, actually I can give it to you for your notes once I finish, is about how the older I get, the more I notice and I take photos of beautiful things that grow in harsh places, especially small beautiful things like a flower that will grow up through a crack in the concrete. Or the other day I was out walking and I saw a little mushroom growing in the middle of a dead sort of tree stump. And I'm very drawn to that because while the world's full of big, beautiful things, those very small, beautiful things that grow up like a flower in the weeds kind of strike me. And just as you were saying, it's like that in life where if we can look for in ourselves, and in others as a natural consequence, but in ourselves, the small, beautiful things that grow up in the harshest places of our lives and celebrate them. So, for example, you know, with grief and the harshness of that, but sometimes the little gifts that grow up that you didn't expect and you weren't looking for can actually take your breath away if you look hard enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is so true. And I think that paying attention to the tiny small gifts that come with hardship, that come because of grief, I think it's giving us, at least for me, hope that not everything is completely destroyed. And out of the what seems like to be the ruins of my life, I can see some sprouts of life coming. Mm-hmm. And this podcast, for example, I have so much hope that this will actually become something that is flourishing and that can bless and really enrich somebody else's life, if not at least just give people an idea of, gosh, I'm not the only one that is feeling like this, because we cannot fix grief, but we can. Hearing the stories of other people and seeing the beauty that came out in their lives from the grief can give us hope. And I think hope is everything, especially when you feel so distraught, because when somebody that you love dies, it's almost like hope goes on coma and you don't know if it's going to come back. And it's really important to find ways to maintain our hope alive. You know, for me, I couldn't do that for myself.
But I thank God that I had the kids because I had to maintain my hope alive for their sake. And by doing that for their sake, I'm like 3 years down this journey, which is just a drop in the bucket. But now I am starting to find what are the beautiful things that I can start to look for in my own life for me, not just for them. And this for me is a signal that I am shifting from the survival mode into seeking, into thriving and pushing my life towards that tiny little steps at a time.
It's beautiful.
And I want to talk a little bit about that in terms of creating. How do you create beauty when you don't see any beauty around you? And one of the things that I did a lot, and I know that you can relate to that because you're a writer, is that I wrote. I wrote a lot. And I didn't intend my writing to be beautiful. But the feedback that I got was that it was heartbreakingly beautiful. And I know that a lot of people that probably listening to this go, oh, I'm not a writer. I don't know how to write. I'm not creative. But how do we maybe use writing as a tool to bring some relief or some beauty into our journey of grief and help us to kind of unpack that and process that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And it's made me think of a lot of other things as well as writing, but to focus on writing first. Number one, I think if you're not a writer and the thought of writing causes you stress, for example, if someone asks me to draw, it causes me so much stress that, you know, it's not, it negates the, the whole purpose. So if you're in that camp and writing's not for you, just first off, there's many other things you can do in the name of grief, or in the name of whatever it is you're going through, such as pottery or art, if you're an artist, or gardening, creating a beautiful garden in the memory of someone, anything you can do that will connect you to more of the, you know, more of your spirit, that real connection point. It could be, you know, any number of things, knitting something, sewing something. It doesn't have to be only writing. But for those of you that do find joy in writing, there's so many avenues you can go down. And one of the ones that's really powerful, you know, is even writing a letter to the person that's passed away. If you felt that there were things that you never got to say that you wanted to say, writing a series of letters, even writing poetry, writing a stream of consciousness where you don't even need to worry about full stops or capital letters, just scribble, 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 getting everything out that's inside you onto a piece of paper can be quite a weight off, even if it's just for a little while. Doing that repeatedly.
That reminds me of what you said about when we're talking about the grounding exercise, that allowing that emotion to go through its cycle and wash it through you. What writing does for me is exactly that. Like as I write, it's like a lot of anger might come out in my words, and by the time my hands too sore to write anymore, or my fingers are too sore to type, I prefer to handwrite. I think that there is a cycle of the emotion that kind of goes through my body and out of it through the writing. And what I have done in the past was that I go and burn that, because it and often there might be some swearing words in there. There might be things that I might never want my kids to read, because they go, oh, I can't believe mom said this about dad. He's dead, you know. So so I think that this is a really good exercise for me to just write it all down, finding ways, maybe some rituals or some well-being practices that you can allow that emotion that is sitting there and even in your muscles and to just consuming your brain to kind of find its way out of you.
Yeah, that's right. And even to make sense of things, because sometimes when we're writing a whole lot of stuff down that stream of consciousness I was talking about, just write with no concern about who's ever going to read it, or, you know, just purely from your head or your heart down onto the page. Sometimes, even at the time or later on, you can see that a theme has come through or something has come through that even in some little way can help something small make sense. Mm. Mm. And at the very, you know, even if it doesn't completely make sense, it's still the offloading.
Mm.
Yeah, the offloading, which is the therapeutic part of it, which is taking that burden off yourself and putting it onto a piece of paper, even if it's just for temporary relief. Mm.
And with this temporary relief, do you think that personal rituals can help us to create some relief, like short-term and also maybe long-term? And if so, I'm throwing you in the deep end here, like, but what do you think would be some suggestions for rituals that we can create to help relieve that pressure? Because sometimes it just feels like you're inside this pressure cooker, right? And then somebody just needs to kind of take the lid off. But often that person that needs to release the pressure is you.
Yeah.
You need to take responsibility for that, which I resented initially, kind of going, man, I'm going through all of this and now I'm the one that needs to emotionally self-regulate. I'm like, yeah, I need to be the big girl here and yeah. do that. But I felt like I wasn't a big girl anymore. I didn't feel like an empowered woman.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like a little girl scared, having to look after two little girls.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to create some little rituals or some well-being practices for me to feel like, oh my God, okay, I am a woman. I can do this. I went through difficult things in my life, but I had to be quite consistent in doing that. Writing was one of those things for me.
Mm.
Do you have any other suggestions about this?
I'm just thinking, again, everyone's different because for some people, the idea of rituals or whatever, it doesn't sort of flip their switch. But there are people for whom it's very, very important. And I was just thinking about a woman that I counseled probably about 2 years ago. And she had a specific set of rituals that really helped her. And she was very overwhelmed in her grief. And one thing that, and I think she still does it, she'd come home from work each day and she'd light a candle and she'd say that prayer. And I can't remember which one it is, but it's, is it the serenity prayer? Give me the courage to accept the things
that I cannot accept. Yeah. And I can put those on the notes. Yeah, yeah. But some, I think the something about accepting the things that you cannot accept and courage to change the things that you can change and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah. It was that prayer. So she'd say that prayer. She also would say, I think she said it was the Lord's Prayer. And then she had a particular song that she related to her husband who had died. And it was a song that carried her through that time as he was dying. And then it became sort of symbolic to her, this particular, I think it was a worship song, that brought her great sort of faith and courage and hope. So she'd play the song.
Mm.
And that was her ritual after work. And then she'd feel like, she said it was like when she'd come in the door, she said it felt like there was a hole in the floor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. She said she'd open the door and she felt like there was a hole in the floor and she was going to fall into it.
Mm.
And so she had to sort of walk around the hole to her place where she kept her candle, light the candle, say the things she needed to say, play her song, and then she felt like she could make the dinner and carry on.
Mm.
Yeah.
That really struck a chord with me, like just the image of that hole on the floor. I think because I felt like wherever I went, there was a hole, but more so in my home.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, I really love that image of her kind of just walking around the hole, which is almost like, I don't know, just if you think about Indiana Jones, you know, kind of going around this deep, deep hole that you have like no idea what would happen to you if you fall into it. And it's there every day, but you have to kind of find your way crawling around to then this is really much facing the fear, isn't it? And this is really much going back to the beginning of our conversation, living with the things that are really difficult for you, not pretending that they are not there, and not fighting it, but making space around it so that your life eventually can become larger than the hole that's there. That's because beautiful. The hole is always going to be there. Wow. So I think that, oh my God, I can talk to you forever. But I am going to let you go. Before I do that, I think we need to do this again.
We do.
Yes, we need to do this again some other time and unpack some other things.
Yeah.
But so for now, just before we close, there's two last questions that I want to ask you. And one of them is, if you knew that today was your very last day to live on this earth, how would you choose to spend your day?
Without question, I would gather my family around me and I would specifically talk to each one of them about, even though I hope they already know, but I would specifically speak to each one of them about their own beauty, about what I see in them, about my hopes and dreams and prayers for their future, and a massive blessing on them. Once I'd done that, if there was more time left, then I'd gather in my closest friends and do the same.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I love it. It just makes, every time I ask this question, there is one common thread, and it's always people saying that they would spend time with the people that they love. And it makes me think, every time I finish this podcast, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to write a text to my kids.
Yeah.
I'm just going to write a quick text to, you know, my sister and or give her a quick call. Because the reality is we are sitting here talking about this metaphorically, but it could happen.
It could.
And so, yeah, we don't want to waste the days that we have. All right. So last question. Say now that if you knew that you had 1 year and that's it, and then you had only 1 year to live, what would be the legacy that you wanted to leave behind?
Oh, I think for me, it's less about fame and fortune, although I would like some of my poems and writings to get published and go a bit further afield than just on my computer.
They need to, because they are so amazing.
And it's more about individual lives. So I would hope that something I'd said or something I'd done or some way that I'd been with someone would have left a print somewhere in their heart or in some way made a difference in their life where they could feel that they wanted to go on and do the same for someone else. Yeah.
So creating some kind of paying it forward.
You know that feeling when you're in someone's presence and you feel completely accepted and supported, and then you feel like you want to go and do that for someone else.
Yeah. I have that feeling when I'm with you, Vic.
So do I, with you.
I love you so much. Okay, so this is the very end of our podcast. Thank you so much for being our guest today. And so listeners, if you enjoyed this, you will be able to find Victoria Hathaway. I will put, you know, her website and some contacts. If you need counseling, she is absolutely amazing. I will put that her details on the show notes. And if you enjoy the show, if you please leave us a review, subscribe to this channel, and spread it around, because I think the best thing that we can do for people who are grieving is to let them know that other people go through similar things. They are not alone in their loneliness. We can be alone together. Light and peace. Thank you so much.
Thank you.